Session number 8255, Richard Broom, part one.
Could we start at the Japanese attack in December 1941? And could you tell me what you were doing then, please?
Well, I was in the Malayan Civil Service, a permanent member of the Malayan Civil Service, and I was stationed then in the town of Ipoh, which is in the north of Malaya, in the role of what was known as Assistant Protector of Chinese. And we were not allowed to join the volunteers, but I was in the air raid protection as well in Ipoh. When the Japanese invasion began, we, of course, were totally ignorant about what to expect. We were grossly misinformed in our own minds about the capabilities of the Japanese and so on. However, when I was called on to do a bit of work for the air raid precautions, because we did have an air raid, and the Chinese members of the ARP were extraordinarily good on that occasion. But that air raid resulted in an almost total voluntary evacuation of Ipoh town. And while this was on, and when the Japanese were about 20 miles north of the town, I received orders from my headquarters to report to Singapore for special duties. Now, the reason, actually, why I was chosen for these special duties was because in 1937, when there was a big communist putsch in Malaya, I had quite a lot of liaison with the police. And also, of course, I spoke Chinese, so that was why I was picked for this. and I got down to Singapore and reported at the address given. And I was taken into an office and interviewed by a chap. And he said, "We want you to stay behind if and when Singapore falls, to look after our agents." These were Secret Service agents that he was referring to. And I was a bit taken aback about this, because there were very obvious signs that this chap and his office were packing up at that time. It was not an assignment which, on the face of it, was at all pleasant. And particularly, they had no idea how their operations worked or how many agents they had. When I asked, they said there was only one. And that, again, was a bit disconcerting. However, one couldn't, under those circumstances, say no on no account. So I made a rather half-hearted consent and walked out of his office. Only to run straight outside the door, I ran into another chap, also in uniform, who introduced himself as Major Goodfellow. And as I learnt later, he had been an employee of ICI, but he was then seconded for special duties in what was then known as the Ministry of Economic Warfare, MEW, but later became SOE and, of course, Force 136, as far as Malaya was concerned. Well, he took me to his office in a different part of town, and he said, I know what those fellows were talking to you about. You don't want to join them, do you? And I said, "Well, frankly, no." And he said, "You're quite right. They should join us. We're a much better organization." And he gave me a very good explanation of what they were doing, and it struck me as much more worthwhile and more in my line. So I consented with great relief. And this was to organize underground resistance in Malaya on the assumption that the Japanese were going to take it over, using communist Chinese whose services had already been offered to the British government to fight the Japanese. And these Chinese were already in training at a special operations school in Singapore. what I was to do was to go and pick up a party of between 15 and 20 people and drive with them up to the front line and find a convenient hiding place near the road, but especially into the jungle or the rubber, for these people to conceal themselves and hide, and while the fighting passed over them, and then to emerge behind the lines and do what they could in the way of sabotage to the Japanese war effort. Well, this is how I got involved in it, and I took the first party up, and the furthest north we could get then was a place called Sorrento in Pera, and I put them in and made a suitable speech in Chinese to them and came back home. And immediately after that, I realized that it was a bit of a lonely occupation, and I wanted some help, and I asked whether I could have my great friend John Davis from the Malayan police, also a Chinese speaker, to be a partner. And to my delight, they said certainly, and started to look for him straight away. He was already in the jungle doing other things, and this message was passed to him, and he was very relieved to get that, because it was a much nicer job for him. And so he came and joined me, and after that we operated as a pair for the rest of the war.
Under what kind of basis of relationship with each other?
Well, before, to start with, entirely together, as it were. We hadn't thought of ranks or anything at all at that stage. But, of course, that couldn't hold, not when we got in with the army in the end. It held until we reached India, in fact. Even though we were under military officers, they seemed to regard us as sort of a bit of an anomaly and just a linked pair. But when we got to India, somebody had to take command, and we decided that Davis should. The point being, Davis was much more a man of action, a much more used to the jungle work and that sort of thing, and much more suited to command than I reckoned I was. I was suited to push him in the right direction and so on. So he became the commanding officer.
You said that you gave that speech to the Chinese. What was the content of what you said?
Well, it was chiefly to say we were all in this war together. We were fighting the Japanese, and I waved a fist and that sort of thing. And it was generally just sort of pep talk. That was all. It was very successful anyway. The mere fact that I was doing it in Chinese was the important thing.
When you say waved a fist, you mean gave a communist salute?
A communist salute, yes, 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 yes.
Why were communist Chinese chosen?
Because they were the only organized Chinese. There was a very considerable war effort going on in the non-Chinese communist world, as we realized later when we met this great friend of ours, Lim Bo Seng. But the only ones who were organized on what you could describe as any kind of military basis was the communists, who had been fighting against us and had been sabotaging the war effort as far as they possibly could until Hitler invaded Russia, when they immediately changed sides, and of course the Japanese invasion also made them totally change sides, and then they just offered their services to the British government.
The Japanese invasion of Malaya or China?
Of China too, of course. That had its effect on their attitude.
And you say that they'd staged the putsch, or attempted putsch, in 1937. What had you seen of that?
Quite a lot. I was I was in the Chinese protectorate, one of whose duties was to look after labourers, working people of all kinds, on estates and mines. And this putsch was really a series of strikes which they organized throughout the mines and the estates in the state of Selangor, where I was stationed, but also elsewhere. So as our duty was to deal with these labouring people. Whenever there was a strike, we went out to try to settle it. And so I was very much face to face with the communists at that time.
How does the putsch element come in? Because was the strike directed at employers or the state?
It was directed at employers. Yes, it was not. It was not directed at the state. It was directed at employers, but it also involved a considerable amount of violence. You see, so the police were involved in it. And there was a good deal of anti-British propaganda involved with it too, of course. And as I was the assistant protector and very close touch with all these things, that was brought me in very close touch with the police as well.
Was it possible that your activities in suppressing that putsch might have affected your later relationship with the communists?
No, not at all. I don't think I was known at all in that respect. Not at all. With my relationships with the Labour side would have been entirely favourable as far as the communists were concerned, because we didn't take sides. If anything, we were helping the labourers to get a fair wage and so on. That was really the role of our department in that respect.
When you call these Chinese communists, to what extent would they be knowledgeable about communist texts like Marx and so on?
I once made an estimate of that. In the whole of the communist organization, you could say that there were about 5% of the leading ones who were true communists by conviction and did know the texts and so on. And then there was about another 20% perhaps, who were leadership material, second grade leadership material, who knew vaguely what it was about, and in any case were ambitious people, ready for what you might call promotion in the higher in the communist hierarchy. And that leaves another 75% who were just ordinary Chinese who had a resentment against the Japanese because of the Japanese invasion of their country, and who probably were out of work because of the Japanese invasion of Malaya, and were quite anxious to have a go, any kind at all. These were the main body of the Chinese communists that we were with.
What kind of social background would they have come from?
They were mostly where we were. They were mostly mining coolies. Some were rubber estate ones, but mostly mining coolies, and similar occupations of the low grade income type, really.
Did that also include the leadership and the well informed ones?
Yes, I think it. Well. So much of I knew of the leadership. In fact, they were several of them were shopkeepers and such, and school teachers too. School teachers either in Chinese schools or sometimes in English schools. When I say English schools, that were government schools teaching in English as a medium of instruction, and some of the leadership came from that class.
What kind of character did they have? Is it possible to generalize? Were they admirable people or not?
It's possible to generalize only by particularizing first, because the one that both Davis and I really liked was Chen Ping, who was at that time the number two in the whole of the communist hierarchy. And he was personally a very splendid chap. We got on with him extremely well, and he was totally reliable as far as we were concerned. The next one that we had any dealings with was the actual number one, Lai Tak. But he was a devious chap, with a very curious and devious background. We didn't see a great deal of him, actually. It was Chen Ping that we saw. Now, the third leader with whom we had plenty of contact with was the chap who was in charge of the Chinese bodyguard, if you would call it that, of about 20 chaps who lived with us in camp. And this chap was an extremely nice fellow, and very, most of the time, very friendly. But he was intellectually of a much lower grade, and he had learnt all the texts and that sort of thing, and came out with all the trite remarks at the right time, which didn't inspire much confidence in his actions and so on. And I think that was a fairly numerous type, what I call the lower grade leadership.
I think you were going to generalize from the particular, I think you said.
Yes, well, the particular being Chen Ping, and getting down to the what I would call the third grade, which is the leader of our own bodyguard. I didn't meet any others actually the whole time.
In what way was Lai Tak devious?
We know more about him subsequently than I knew then, but he was playing with the Japanese during the whole of that time. I think we were lucky that he did betray a lot of Chinese communists to the Japanese. He was a born double agent type, we would say.
Did you like him at the time, or was it...
Wasn't possible to like or dislike him. We didn't know him well enough. We met him merely on a couple of occasions when we were negotiating a treaty, as it were, with them. And superficially got on with him very well. But as we didn't really know much of his background at that time, and we didn't have any social relations with him, we didn't really know. It was later after the war that one learnt the whole of his background.
And why was Chen Ping admirable?
It was just his character. He was, Davis put it once in one of his books, one of the books which you once read. The normal communist reaction in... When you have to make a statement about something during a conference or something like that, is to consider first its effect on the party line, and second, its truth, you see. That's been demonstrated over and over again with us. You cannot rely on the statement of the normal communist leader at that echelon anyway. But that did not apply to Chen Ping. He would tell the truth as far as he possibly could, although of course there came a point when he wouldn't, and he let it be known fairly clearly that he just wasn't really speaking the truth at that point. But he was, we found, totally reliable.
How did he make it clear?
To begin with, he would say, you know, that our objectives are not the same. Your objective is to re-establish the British colonial rule in this country, and we don't want it back, we want a communist rule in this country. And that is the basis of our relationship. It was his manner. It was very difficult to say how he made it clear, but we knew fairly well that... if he was merely quoting the party line, we knew when it was.
Now, can we go back to where I interrupted the narrative?
Yeah.
Where you had just said that you'd given this speech.
Well, I went back to Singapore, and then I was joined by John Davis, and we took a second batch up. And to cut it short, we took, I think, a total of 7 batches up, each of about 15 to 20 chaps. And each time, because of the rapid Japanese advance, the journey got less and less and less. And finally, the last dump, we put in dumps of arms with these people, of course. The last lot we put in was in Johor Bahru, just across the straits from Singapore.
What type of area would you dump them in?
Well, we couldn't get very far off the main roads because there wasn't time. We dumped them, if possible, in an area of jungle by the side of the main road.
And what type of equipment would you leave with them?
Well, they had their individual arms, of course, and supplies of explosives, detonators, timing devices, and all the kind of thing that sabotage operations require.
Would you leave money with them?
Yes, we left money with them too.
What kind of currency?
Oh, that was in our own Malayan currency. It was early days for Japanese hadn't even got any Malayan currency then.
And so they were expected to survive just by buying their food?
That's right, yes, yes.
Was there any expectation that they might have to cultivate themselves?
Yes, there was. I think we were prepared for that, although we didn't actually give them any tools or anything like that. The expectation was a little bit difficult to visualize because I think it was felt that Singapore would hold out for a long time, and indeed it might be that Singapore would hold out until reinforced and we could get back again. Those were very misguided ideas, really. And if the thinking went beyond that and went to the point where we would be defeated in Singapore and have to get out, it was a long-term business. These people wouldn't have been expected to hang around in the jungle. They would have come out and joined the population.
Why was it? Was it just Chinese who were selected?
Entirely, yes. Yes. The reason for that is historical. The Malayan Communist Party was founded by people coming down from China, and they did their best to make it a multiracial affair, they never succeeded. One or two Malays joined, but they didn't last very long. To all intents and purposes, the Malayan Communist Party was a Chinese Communist Party. In fact, the ordinary Malay, at the time of the war, communist and Chinese were almost synonymous.
Why was that, when there was obviously a large proportion of Chinese who weren't?
Yeah, perhaps I phrased it wrongly. It was the people that the Malay policemen and so on had to deal with. That's to say, the enemy, as far as the police were concerned, they were communists and therefore Chinese. And then you could use either term, you see. I'm not suggesting that the greater part of the Chinese population, which was non-political, was called communist by the Chinese. It wasn't so. But when talking about the after the war, the Chinese terrorists and so on, the Malay police anyway would always say either Chinese or communist.
Did the Malayan Communist Party have any success with the Tamils?
No, not really.
Why do you think that was?
The majority of the Tamil population were immigrants from India who came over to tap the rubber trees. And they were not highly educated, in any case. And I don't think they were just political material for the communists. The other better educated ones were in good clerk's jobs and that sort of thing, and I don't think they were interested in the communists at all. Very few Indians involved.
Were there any pro-Japanese sections of the civilian population in Malaya?
Were the Japanese section?
No, were there any pro-Japanese sections of
no,
the
no,
population?
No, not a soul.
Not even amongst the Malays or Tamils?
Oh, I beg your pardon. There may have been some, yes. I'm sorry, we'd have to scrub that a little bit when I said not a soul. I was thinking of my own content. Yes, the Malays had always had a back of the mind resentment of the vast immigration of Chinese, you see. And it didn't sort of show itself in any strong action, but they, at the back of their minds, there was a feeling that it was that they wished the Chinese went there and so on. Now, many of those regarded the Japanese arrival as going to rid them of the Chinese. And there was a certain sympathy with the Malay, with the Japanese invaders. It didn't last long. The Japanese themselves just destroyed all the friendship they might have had, even from the Malays, by their general behaviour.
Specifically, what in their behaviour?
Well, they were always they were terribly heavy-handed. They were the bosses. They were far more heavy-handed than the British would ever thought of being. If you got into a, I was told by people, if you got into a train and a Japanese came in, even if you were only a sergeant, you were ordered out. He had his own apartment to himself. That sort of attitude throughout, and of course. The massacre of enormous numbers of Chinese in Singapore and that sort of thing. Well, that the Malays didn't like that sort of thing either. Even if it was Chinese, wholesale massacre was not their idea at all.
Was there any pro-Japanese section of the Chinese population?
No, I should say not a single one. I cannot think of any.
And the Tamils?
I doubt very much if there were any. Unless you go further on into the war when the Japanese were recruiting people into their Indian army, but those were Indian troops that they had in the prisons anyway.
Now, going back to the narrative, you were talking about the ferrying of the bands of agents northwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me what happened to you next?
Yes, well, when we put the last party in Johor, we had a conference at what to do next and decided that we would try to re-establish contact with these parties we'd put in by the back door, by sea. And an operation was mounted under the command of Colonel Warren of the Royal Marines, who was in this MEW business, to put Davis and me in on the Malayan coastline, and also a couple of other English people who were on a different mission to try and rescue British troops who were hanging about in the jungle and so on. We commandeered a Chinese motor junk thing called the Hin Li, which was a little cargo boat. And we set off from Singapore Harbour about a week before Singapore fell and got over to the Sumatra coast, the place called Bagan Siapiapi, which is a big fishing port there. And the intention was to hire a Chinese sailing sampan to take Davis and me over to the Malayan side to see what we could do to make contact. And the crew, we sort of chartered this boat with the...